Good morning. This is the International Connection. My name is Adam Vaughn. And as always on Saturday mornings, I'm joined by Bob Marshall and Tom Rich. Today we're going to take a look at audio file number 54 from Dr. Peter Beter. Bob, what are the contents of this mysterious tape?
Well, this was recorded in February 1980, and regular listeners to my summaries of Dr. Beter's tapes will note that he talks about a nuclear first strike by the Bolshevik-controlled Pentagon against Russia. He's right now I'm talking about how he is leading up to a first strike he predicts in the fall of 1982. However, a first strike took place in January 1980, and we're going to hear what happened in that cold month.
Now, Dr. Beter is also the one responsible for the concept of robotoids and a number of other fairly outlandish remarks. So bear in mind that although what you're about to hear is documented by the fact that it's distributed widely in the States, it's not necessarily true. We didn't die in a nuclear war 4 years ago. Fair enough, Bob?
Fair enough.
Okay. Let's take a listen.
War talk is now swirling all around us. Like a giant whirlpool, it is spreading wider and wider, sucking in everything around it. The overthrown Bolsheviks from Russia, who now control America, will use anything and everything to achieve their goals. They care about nothing at all but war, revolution, and catching us all in their swirling hell of satanic power. As always, innocent victims are the key to Bolshevik designs. Today, these innocent victims are countless Olympic athletes whose dreams of glory are drowning in the vortex of Bolshevik intrigue. Tomorrow, the Bolsheviks intend for the victims to be you and me by the millions. And it will not be just our dreams which are snuffed out, but our very lives. Because human sacrifice on a grand scale is always a hallmark of Bolshevik schemes for power. Earlier this month, our situation was summed up accurately by an anti-draft speaker to students at Berkeley, California. He said, quote, "We all live in Guyana now," unquote. The Bolsheviks here in America are shutting down our land as they prepare for nuclear war and Bolshevik dictatorship. The threat to revoke passports of athletes who want to go to the Moscow Olympics is only the beginning. Most Americans still do not understand what is happening, but the trap is already closing around us all. My three special topics this month are topic number one, the secret American defeat of January 1980. Topic number two, weather modification as a weapon of retaliation. And topic number three, Russia's accelerating preparations to survive nuclear war. Topic number one, 4 days ago on February...
Now, let's jump in there just temporarily. This has got to be taken on the fact that this was spoken about in 1980, and the events we're about to hear are what's to come in the next few years, and I think that should be taken into account before we actually listen to the...
No, this is an event that took place in January 1980. As he said, it's a defeat of Americans. So it's the first strike that occurred, but the Russians succeed in stopping it.
So as of 1980, the Bolsheviks have taken over the United States.
Oh, yeah. They took over in early 79 when they offed the Rockefellers.
Okay. So what we're about to hear then is an accounting of that plus predictions for the future.
We're going to hear an accounting of a first strike attempt in January 80, which is almost a year after the death of Nelson. And what I'm doing on my summaries each week, I'm up into the 1982 tapes where he's leading into the next first strike attempt by the Bolshevik Pentagon in September 1982. But this is an earlier attempt.
Okay, now, one of the things that's very hard to crystallize is the thought that the United States was taken over. What examples or what evidence is discussed that we should be looking out for?
You notice where he said the Bolsheviks will shut down America. Well, by 81 and 82, unemployment and financial problems were really serious in the United States, and this is what you could say it could be have been predicted by a lot of economists, but Dr. Beter predicted it, and it did happen. But he gives the reasons behind the scenes, the power struggle among these secret teams.
Bob, wasn't this takeover, though, by the Bolsheviks a process where it started with the Battle of the Harvest Moon that Beter had mentioned, then the assassination of Rockefeller? So it wasn't a one-time thing. There was a process here that we've been talking about every week with Beter.
Yes, in 1977, the Bolsheviks upset the Rockefellers in the Battle of the Harvest Moon, where they knocked out the Rockefeller moon base. However, unknown to the Bolsheviks, a secret Christian faction had infiltrated the power structure in Russia for 60 years and inherited the benefits of that victory by the Bolsheviks over the Rockefellers, kicked the Bolsheviks out. The Rockefellers in 78 temporarily aligned with the Bolsheviks, but Dr. Beter said this was an act that would be the undoing of the Rockefellers, and that happened by early 79 when the Bolsheviks knocked off the Rockefellers and then took over the Pentagon. Hence, you had the financial crisis in 80, 81, 82 of the Rockefeller cartel, and that's why Dr. Beter says they had to the Rockefeller faction under John McCloy had to raise the interest rates just to keep the cash flow going for their own interests. But the Pentagon had hijacked the government budget under Reagan.
This is all very startling stuff to someone who lived through that period and was fairly conscious of what was happening around them or thought they were. I guess we'll listen to the tape and listen to some of the more concrete evidence that he brings forward and then discuss it at length a little bit later.
Okay.
And topic number three, Russia's accelerating preparations to survive nuclear war. Topic number one, 4 days ago on February 20, the United States Olympic ultimatum against Russia expired. That day, Pravda and the official Soviet news agency TASS said that the Politburo member Mikhail Suslov had given a speech at a town on the Volga River. The speech was actually a collective response by the Kremlin to American actions. The answer to the expiration of the Olympic ultimatum was, quote, "The Soviet people will not be intimidated," unquote. Then, America was described as using Afghanistan as a pretext for blackmail and threats. And in answer to that, Suslov said, quote, "The American government's actions will inflict damage mainly to the United States itself," unquote. The Russians plan to make these words come true, my friends. They plan to let the United States walk into one military trap after another. Each time they plan to let the Bolsheviks here in America believe they are springing a surprise. But each time, the Russians intend to be one step ahead. Each time the Bolshevik dragon shows a fang, the Russians intend to pull it. And so, as Suslov put it a few days ago, the American government's actions will inflict damage mainly to the United States itself. The new Russian master strategy was already at work when I recorded audio letter 53 last month. At that time, I revealed that the Bolsheviks had already set in motion the August 1978 plan for a nuclear first strike against Russia. The secret planners of the American operation fully expected that the operation could lead to nuclear war I before the end of January. But last month, I reported that the secret American nuclear strike operation against Russia was already in deep trouble. First, the Israeli-piloted American submersible aircraft in the White Sea and Caspian Sea were blasted out of existence on January 20. I was able to report that to you last month, and so I won't describe it all again now. The important thing to recall is that the Russians had lured the American subcraft into a trap where they were destroyed. And their destruction took place under conditions which prevented the Bolsheviks here from learning about it immediately. As a result, other parts of the American nuclear strike plan were still going ahead. When I recorded my audio letter last month on January 21, I reported that American RPVs were being rushed to Sinkiang Province, Red China. An RPV is a remote control airplane, and those which were on their way to China last month were very special. They were relatively small and hard to spot, very fast, and able to outmaneuver any known anti-aircraft missile. Like the subcraft, the RPVs were essential to the attack plan which I first revealed in August 1978. When I revealed the attack plan, I also explained how desperate America's ruling circles were to gain access to China's Xinjiang province. This was a geographic key to the plan for using American RPVs to attack Russia's Cosmosphere installations in Siberia. But it took nearly a year and a half before China finally agreed to the plan. The breakthrough came during the urgent trip to China early last month by the United States Secretary of Defense. Right away, we started hearing rumors in the news about a military alliance with Red China. Part of the price of the deal was for the United States to afford Red China most favored nation trade status immediately. And so, as his trip to China ended, the White House suddenly started leaning on Congress to act fast. By January 20, China was given a guarantee that it would be passed. And 4 days later, our rubber stamp House and Senate approved most favored nation status for Red China by overwhelming margins. The Bolshevik war planners here in the United States did not wait for the actual vote. They were in a hurry. On January 21, the RPVs were on their way to China, as I reported last month. I can now report that they arrived in Xinjiang province the same day I recorded audio letter 53, January 21. There were 14 RPVs. Seven were to be launched at Semipalatinsk, where Russia's cosmospheres and particle beam weapons are assembled. The other seven were to be launched at Novosibirsk, where the operational cosmosphere base is located. And each RPV carried a multi-megaton hydrogen bomb with a cobalt jacket. In nuclear bombs lingo, they were extremely dirty bombs, designed to blanket the target area with a deadly radiation for decades. But last month, I reported that four separate Russian commando groups were poised on the border, waiting for the RPVs. When they did arrive on January 21, the Russians waited only long enough to make sure all the RPVs were in place. Then around midnight that night, the Russians began moving in. Just in case, there were also 45 Cosmospheres hovering over the area, but they were not needed. The Russian commandos achieved a complete surprise, and it was all over in a matter of minutes. The RPVs were all blown up, and the camp was overrun. In November 1978, a secret Russian missile base in Guyana, about which I had been warning publicly for 4 years, was destroyed. Joint American and Israeli commando forces took the base by storm and killed every single Russian on the base, as I reported in audio letter 40. But last month, the Russians evened the score. Russian commandos wiped out the secret American RPV base in Xinjiang province, China, and not one member of the joint American and Israeli forces at the base was spared.
Well, this is all very convenient. Secret armies wiping out secret army bases and fighting with secret armies, with secret cosmospheres, and secret this and secret that. It sounds more like the musings of a paranoid science fiction writer than an actual news discoverer. These wars, this blanket radiation that was put down for centuries to come, radiation drifts in clouds, and it would be picked up somewhere else somehow. It seems absolutely unfathomable that none of this has been documented by anybody else but Dr. Peter Beter.
Right. Well, I think he explains that later in the tape about the radiation. But what's interesting, the only Pentagon Bolshevik he named in his tapes was John Singlaub. And John Singlaub is now becoming a household word in 1985. Due to Reverend Moon's papers like Washington Times and complaints from Congress that he's been funding and directing the financing of these private armies like the Contras in Nicaragua and the surrounding areas. So there was some unwarranted financing going on the last 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, but what does that have to do with wars in China?
Well, the Beter explains that the myth of waste in the Pentagon budget is the cover story. These cost overruns that the Pentagon is notorious for is the way this money is funded into these other weapons. For example, the MX missile is a cover for the TX missile. I grant you, we don't have any proof of this, But it's been a pretty tense world the last 5 years, and people have picked it up intuitively, and maybe these kind of things have been going on.
I think the key to what you just said there is that it's been picked up intuitively. If it is intuitive, it's not necessarily true.
No, but the tensions are manifested in the immediate rise of the peace movement in the early 80s. People all of a sudden got very concerned. Why weren't they concerned in 1975? Why wasn't there a nuclear movement then?
Because you had a president in the mid-70s who wasn't as hawkish as Reagan. I think it's the attitude of the people in power more than their actual policies that are causing rise to concern. Tom, you wanted to say something.
Well, I wanted to address your point about why hasn't this been reported, and this is a good point to bring in our other sources. The LaRouche organization has written that the overall flow of so-called news is regulated at national, international, and regional points of wire service and other agencies' administration and control the flow of news copy. So that even if somebody did report this, what I'm saying is perhaps it has been reported, but it wasn't picked up by the major national services, because if this were the case, we can also assume that the major news services under control of the government's operation would quash it.
It's getting very paranoid. I mean,
it's not paranoid.
You've linked together Congress's approval of the China trade agreement with wire service conspiracy to cover up secret wars, with the Pentagon's overspending being because they're actually spending more on different weapons that they're not telling you. I mean, all these things seem to very conveniently fit into this jigsaw puzzle, yet I don't see them any of the pieces actually being on the table to be fitted in to begin with.
Well, I don't think it's too bizarre after Watergate and many other episodes.
But Watergate was discovered.
But Watergate was discovered, but there certainly have been many others that haven't been discovered.
You can't say
and
that.
The point is whether it discovered is not the point. The point is there are a group trying to keep it from the public's from the public, and there's a group that's trying to get it out. And if one group wins and the other group doesn't, the fact that Watergate was released doesn't mean that there weren't other stories, more important, that were squashed.
Yeah, but you're playing on people's ability to distrust government, and I don't think that necessarily making up these grandiose schemes and that sort of distrust of government are necessarily either related or necessarily should they be thrown into one kettle and made into one stew.
Well, we just heard news this week of the fact that files with regard to the Nazis are missing.
Were accidentally destroyed.
Yeah, no, do you? I find it hard to believe that they were accidentally destroyed. I'm more of a person who is a doubting Tom. Doubting Thomas. I don't believe that as easily. I'm willing to say, well, just a second, that sounds too pat.
Now, this is what May Brussels been talking about, the importance of the Nazi war criminals, and again, I've been documenting her stuff for a year now, and now we have, again, files destroyed in Canada. I mean, if people want to get into a doubting Thomas frame of mind, you start with May Brussels and move through Skolnick, which are showing us stuff that can be visible, it's documented, and then we find in that context the revelations of Dr. Beter interesting. I grant you it's hard to take it out of the blue without any familiarity in this subject. But
listen, I've been listening to this subject for the last few months, and even with my grounding in the subject, I find it hard to believe. I can believe May and Sherman insofar as, if I can even use their first names, which is perhaps an indication of the familiarity, but I can forgive them their transgressions because they're at least an attempt to document it. Beter answers all criticism by saying, I've got sources in high places, and if I name them, they'll be killed. I can't do it. I mean, that's a very convenient excuse.
It isn't convenient, but as Dr. Peters explained, you can trust intelligence by its reliability, and many things that he predicted.
So where's the nuclear war?
Well, he's explaining why this one didn't happen, and we'll explain why the one in September...
Yeah, but I can explain why the Titanic didn't make it across the ocean.
Yeah, but you weren't making tapes and had to come up with a reason.
But I can explain the reason the Titanic didn't make it across the ocean, because there's documents to show that it was trying to. Why can't you explain that the Russians didn't get to the moon first? I mean, it's easy to explain the failure of something if it never happened to begin with.
Yeah, but we've been over this before. I know that the Beter is hard to believe, but I think we should hear what he has to say. It's certainly, he had no reason to do this. I mean, he didn't make any money or anything from this. Well, he said he did it for history because nobody would know. So I think a man who worked for the CIA has something to say. Maybe he went crazy, but it's a phenomenon that we should hear. So let's go on and hear more.
Fair enough.
As the Chinese dawn broke over the smoldering ruins of the American RPV base, January 23 was working its way around the globe. That evening, the latest replica for the late President Jimmy Carter was scheduled to be on television. It was to be a tough speech, setting the stage for war itself to erupt within days. But the Bolshevik military planners here in America were in a state of upheaval. The RPV operation in China had turned into a disaster, so it was obvious that the Russians were now on the alert. The decision was made to freeze all other parts of their nuclear first strike operation to assess the situation. Coded signals were flashed to the non-existent subcraft in the White and Caspian Seas to continue holding at their final checkpoints. At the same time, another subcraft operation was getting underway in the Black Sea. 29 subcraft were involved, and all were ordered to stop in their tracks and await further orders. The Black Sea subcraft operation was not a part of the original plan, which I revealed a year and a half ago. But during that time, Russia's particle beam weapons program has caused additional targets to be added to the Bolshevik first strike plan. Three of the most important new targets are at Kharkov, Voronezh, and Kazan, as I will explain in topic number 3. The first two were to be attacked from the Black Sea. The third target, Kazan, was to be approached from the Caspian by subcraft using the huge Volga River. When the Black Sea subcraft were ordered to halt on January 23, many were still close to their bases in northern Turkey. 11 subcraft were ranged along Russia's Crimean sea coast, but the rest were still in Turkish waters. That presented the Russians with a slight dilemma. As I reported last month, the Russians preferred not to use their most important weapons right now, where they can be observed in action. But it soon became clear to the Russians that the Bolsheviks were getting cold feet and would shortly order the subcraft back to their bases. Soon after night fell across the Black Sea on January 23, the Russian High Command gave the order to attack the subcraft. There were 92 cosmospheres hovering over the Black Sea at that time. Each subcraft was being tracked continuously by at least 3 cosmospheres, using their psychoenergetic range-finding equipment, that is, PRF. When the attack order was given, selected cosmospheres started firing their charged particle beam weapons downward into the sea far below them. Each subcraft was resting motionless a short distance underwater, not nearly deep enough to avoid destruction. And so, each subcraft erupted briefly into a brilliant cloud of steam and debris. Then the sea was dark once again. Chance observers ashore and on ships saw nothing more than a brief, intense light on a distant horizon, a spark that disappeared as quickly as it had appeared. But to the Bolshevik war planners here in America, those brief sparks on the horizon spelled disaster. They meant that all those nuclear-armed subcraft in the Black Sea would not be available for a second try later on. And the Bolsheviks then guessed correctly that the same was true of the subcraft in the White and Caspian Seas. The destruction of the subcraft in the Black Sea took place just after 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, January 23, 1980. A few short hours later, the so-called Carter Doctrine was proclaimed in the State of the Union speech on television. For public consumption, the United States was still talking tough, threatening to use military force in the Persian Gulf. But later that same evening, January 23, it was the Russians who were doing the really tough talking out of the public eye. Soviet Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin suddenly arrived at the State Department for an unexpected late-night meeting. There he met for an hour and a half with a top-level representative of the Bolsheviks. Dobrynin is famous for the beaming smile he always wears, but he stopped smiling as soon as the meeting began. Speaking with icy precision, he confirmed that Russia had destroyed the American subcraft, and RPVs. He also called attention to an unpublicized disaster earlier that day near northern Greece in the Aegean Sea. A hush-hush oil rig, so-called, had been at work under Norwegian and American control, using German and Dutch workers. But that day, the rig had suddenly gone up in flames, killing everyone aboard. Dobrynin explained that Russia had known what the rig was up to and did not approve. It was preparing to plant nuclear missiles on the ocean floor to be aimed at the heart of Russia. The Russians had waited until the missiles were aboard the platform, ready for planting. Then a trio of cosmospheres overhead had destroyed platform, missiles, and the crew all at once. Finally, Dobrynin added something which was intended to drive home the hopelessness of the Bolshevik war plans. He revealed that Russia knew that there was one more element in the overall first strike plan, which was still underway. A tiny force of four more subcraft were moving into the Baltic Sea, armed with cobalt bombs. They were a suicide force, and they were all heading for a single target, Moscow. They were to approach Russia's Baltic Sea coast underwater until they arrived at widely separated points near Kaliningrad, Riga, and Leningrad. Then when the order came, the plan was for them to surface and make the transition to flight configuration. From there, their mission called for them to take off, arming their cobalt bombs for detonation on impact. Flying their super-quiet subcraft at treetop height, their mission called for them to get as close as possible to Moscow before being shot down. As each suicide subcraft crashed in flames, the cobalt bomb it was carrying would detonate automatically. The Bolshevik war planners here in the United States did not expect that any of them would actually reach Moscow, but they were confident that they would get close enough to do the job. The ground-level detonation of four cobalt bombs would send an enormous cloud of deadly radioactive fallout drifting eastward, and the Bolsheviks here were sure that Moscow, the nerve center of Russia, would not survive. By administering a giant dose of radioactive poison, the Bolsheviks were planning to turn Moscow into a giant Jonestown of silent death. Dobrynin described it all during the meeting. Then he revealed that Russia was tracking all four suicide subcraft. He proved it by giving their locations. Then he said, "I am instructed to inform you that you are now invited to attempt to save these four machines from destruction if you can. You may try to hide them or protect them in any way you choose. You will discover that you cannot. Promptly at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tomorrow, 12 hours from now, they will all cease to exist." The next day, January 24, the Russians made good their threat. One suicide subcraft was near the Russian Baltic coast itself, close to Kaliningrad. Another was well to the west, near the border between East Germany and Poland, where it strikes the coast. The third was far to the north, 30 miles west-northwest of Pori, Finland. And the fourth was clear outside the Baltic, about 70 miles north-northwest of Bergen, Norway. But all four were blasted simultaneously by the cosmospheres hovering in the sky above them. The destruction of the suicide subcraft with their cobalt bombs marked the end of the abortive first strike operation last month. It was a total defeat for the United States, while Russia did not receive so much as a scratch on the arm. And its ramifications are still spreading. For example, the debacle in Sinkiang province was a major shock to China. It has revived the arguments within Chinese ruling circles that the United States is a paper tiger, and the Chinese military commanders who were involved in the Sinkiang affair are in deep trouble. In recent days, reports have begun reaching the West about a major reshuffle in the Chinese military. Russia plans to unseat all of the Bolshevik leaders of China. Meanwhile, my friends, only a few hours ago, I received confirmed evidence about an urgent new development in Iran. The doctors at Tehran Hospital have announced within the past 12 hours that Ayatollah Khomeini will see no visitors until further notice, including religious and political leaders. The doctors say he has been overtaxed. But the real reason, my friends, is that within the past 48 hours, Ayatollah Khomeini was assassinated and replaced by a double. It was the fourth attempt on his life, and this time it succeeded. He was shot above the left eye.
Well, 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 well. Poor Ayatollah. At any rate, a lot went by that time, and it's a good, we don't have much time to discuss it all, but the last comment isn't as important about the Ayatollah. I think that people that have listened to the program for the last little while are well-versed in doubles and robotoids and can probably discern for themselves the validity of that statement. As for the other facts, I'm curious. Why all this war and no comment? I mean, this seems very strange to me.
No comment from who?
From anybody.
Well, you said that there was no nuclear peace movement under Carter in the middle 70s because we didn't have a president like Reagan. Maybe Reagan is not just being a right-wing warmonger. Maybe they have been seriously mad and angry, and the kind of comments he made as soon as he came in 81 were quite warlike and frightened a lot of people. Maybe those were the reactions. Hard to believe.
There was a story that leaked out a couple of weeks ago that I think we discussed about a large explosion that took place at a port in the northern Soviet Union,
right,
which wiped out a large size of their fleet, is the report that did leak out. I think that there's when things like this leak out, there's so much information overload in our daily lives that it's not so that these things could be absolutely positively happening, and we still wouldn't necessarily know of it unless the major media picked it up and brought it to the surface for our attention. Now, Dr. Beter, we've talks about the Battle of the Harvest Moon. Before we end today, I did want to mention a highlight, and that was on September 16th, 1985, the New Solidarity Executive Intelligence Review reported the following. I'd just like to quote it. For the past decade, the Soviet Union has been the only nation in the world that can willfully destroy satellites in orbit. The U.S. program is actually playing catch-up to match this existing Soviet capability, while the Russians are readying their third-generation ASAT systems based on directed energy technologies, unquote.
Now, what's interesting is that LaRouche would have no truck with Dr. Beter, but we here at the International Connection, since we're not biased or prejudiced any particular source, we can use that New Solidarity Executive Intelligence source and see how, well, that's something like what Dr. Beter's talking about.
Well, I don't know. I think that people might even argue with your bias. They might even argue with the facts that you present and how you go about collecting them. I think that the issue is interesting. I think that should be discussed. I'm not sure whether I place a lot of faith in what Dr. Beter has said today. In terms of response to the comment that the quote that you read from the in respect to the arms depot in the north of the Soviet Union being blown up, that was documented as just being an accident. And why can't we just believe that? It's possible, and it's equally as ridiculous as your position.
I think it's more difficult to believe that an accident destroyed a quarter of the Soviet Navy. I think that's a lot harder to believe than to believe in robotoids even.
Okay.
An accident. I don't think they did. They are very highly technological. They put Sputnik into orbit before the Americans. When I see reports that an accident wiped out half their navy, I mean it makes me laugh. It's harder. That's harder for me to believe than the facts.
I think we'll get debates on how much of the navy was actually wiped out. But instead of debating that, I think we'll just simply make the remark that this is the International Connection. Thanks very much for tuning in. Thanks to Tom Rich and Bob Marshall who collect these little bits of information and display it for us. Join us again next Saturday, as always, at the end of File 88, coming to you at 11 o'clock. Thanks very much for Adam Vaughn, Bob Marshall, Tom Rich. Have a good afternoon.
The International Connection is a Bob Marshall production. CKLN looks at the show as an opportunity to expose and deal with radical and dissenting opinions currently being presented in other parts of the world. The comments and views expressed on the show occasionally exceed the established norms of mainstream journalism. As such, The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not the radio station.